change in your feelings can come from different environmental sources or different habits or different changes in your habits. But it's not that with one change of habit, you will only affect your eudaimonic well-being and not your hedonic well-being. And society is also expecting something. So sometimes it's said, well, the easy hedonic stuff is not important, but it is, because you need to feel well. It should start with well-being. And if that makes you happy and then gives you the energy or the openness to change, that is a big step. And that's maybe more important than thriving to be meaningful every day, for example.
Hello and welcome back to the Supporting Champions podcast. My name is Steve Ingham, and in these conversations, I explore the intricate world of human performance, leadership, and personal development with expert guests for you to tune into and reflect, cherry pick ideas from, and develop your thinking. Our focus isn't just on the victories and the accolades, but on the often overlooked journey of how to get there, the hard work, the obstacles, and the resilience required to achieve. Live more fruitfully and enjoy the process. We bring together a diverse range of voices, from coaches and scientists to leaders who've been there and done that, to share their valuable insights. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen or watch, so that you can stay updated with our latest episodes.
Hi, I'm Holly Calvert, professional golfer and co-founder of Athlete Now, and we're proud sponsors of the Supporting Champions podcast. Athlete Now was created with a vision to provide a dedicated space where proven practitioners can connect with athletes and coaches, offering the support needed to reach peak performance. Our platform is designed to make these connections seamless, empowering athletes and coaches to search for and access the best support for their journey. But what can Athlete Now offer you? For practitioners, a place to showcase your services, supported by a platform that appreciates and understands the value of your expertise. We offer you the opportunity to reach a wider audience, connect with athletes and coaches who are in search of the specialized support you provide. Athletes and coaches, free access to search for services that meet your specific needs. Our platform allows you to filter searches by location, experience, accreditation and type of expertise, ensuring you can find the right support exactly when and where you need it. But why join Athlete Now? Well, for practitioners, it's your chance to offer what you do best, supporting athletes and coaches in achieving their goals. By joining our community, you're not just listing your services, you're becoming part of a network dedicated to excellence in performance support. Athletes and coaches, signing up gives you the access to expertise, whether you're looking to enhance your performance, recover from an injury, or refine your strategy. The right support is just a few clicks away. We built Athlete Now to bridge the gap between sporting ambition and performance expertise. By facilitating these crucial connections, we aim to support athletes in meeting their goals and practitioners in expanding their reach. Visit us now at theathletenow.com to get started.
In this episode, I speak to Meka Bartels, a renowned researcher in well-being and happiness. Meka's research work uncovers the layers that contribute to our sense of fulfillment, exploring how genetics, environment, and personal habits intertwine to shape our happiness. In our conversation, Meka highlights that well-being is an evolving state, influenced by positive surroundings and actions. We discuss the differences between eudaimonic and hedonic well-being, the genetic basis of happiness, and the essential balance between work and life for maintaining our well-being. Meka provides real intriguing insights into the genetic factors that account for about 40% of the variation in happiness across populations, opening up discussions about personalized approaches to enhancing well-being. We also cover the exposome concept, illustrating how a wide range of external factors from birth affects our growth and our happiness. We also explore the role of physical activity in mental health, discussing the benefits of finding enjoyable physical activities and the concepts of effort forcing and achieving a flow state for optimal performance and satisfaction. I really enjoy this conversation. Maker is not surprisingly a sunny person, but at the same time, quite straightforward in her advice about making active choices in our lives to enhance our happiness. Maker, very warm welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to chat to you today about your work on the underpinnings of happiness and well-being. And I hope we can explore maybe a little bit about how we can look after ourselves as we live, work and strive. Conscious that maybe our backgrounds have a lot to do with our well-being and happiness, I wonder if you could start me off by telling me a little bit about your background and how you got into this field.
Yes, well, thanks for inviting me. It's lovely to be here. How I started off, well, actually, I did PhD research focusing on the development of emotional and problem behavior in children. And along the whole trajectory, I started realizing that although there are a lot of children with problems, it's still the minority of the population. Also with adults, most adults actually feel well and do well. And that's what we tend to ignore. We take them as a control group and study all the problems and risk factors. And at some point I thought, well, maybe there's a lot of information in the group that's doing well. And what can we learn from those people? Normally we put them in one pile of people with no problems. But there's a lot of variation, people being way more happy than other people, people having high life satisfaction, people that thrive versus people that are on average lower. And well, that started me thinking about studying the positive sides of life.
Amazing. And you've got a smiley emoji cuddly toy on your case there. And I can see to the right about some slogans about smiling and doing what's happy. You sound like you're living the research and you're prompting your interest in your office as well as your life.
Trying. I always say I'm also a human being and have my better and less good moments in life. But no, I think in general, it's an active form of living. So well-being is not a fixed state. And you're a part of it. You are the only one that can run your life. So I hope to help people to realize that well-being is something that sits in you, but can be developed and can be ignited. And you're the only one who's really in control. So that's how I try to live the happy life myself as well.
And so I think that there is a sarcastic comment about psychology students who perhaps there's something that's driving them to understand about something that's upset them in their past. Were you drawn to more positive environments, positive study, positive ideas from an optimistic point of view?
Yes, well, I'm back in the day, still, I'm very interested in the balance between genes and environment in anything that has to do with a human being, and also especially now for well-being and happiness. I think I'm a lucky person being born with a higher genetic predisposition for well-being. So, and a higher genetic predisposition for optimism. So I almost always look at the bright side of life and look at the potential that human beings have and the possibilities instead of the challenges.
So you've had that mapped yourself. You've done the GWAS genetic profiling for yourself and you've gone, look, I've got a few of these. I can tick them off. And that perhaps explains your predisposition.
Yeah, well, in general, genetics is actually easy because people know if they have a high or low genetic predisposition for happiness or well-being. It shouldn't come as a surprise. People know if they look at the bright side, if they feel generally happy, if they feel easily happy versus people that don't have these feelings. So I knew, but I also have been in the position to look at my own genotype. And yes, I was had an above average polygenic score for well-being based on the GWAS studies indeed.
I would imagine I'd probably have a similar outlook. And maybe on some days when I'm feeling blue, I could be, maybe think, yeah, I've got the genes for it. And that's good. Cheer up, Steve. So let's get into the topic then. And we've sort of differentiated a little bit around happiness and well-being. Are there some useful definitions to navigate this space? Is there some differences and some similarities and overlaps in what you would define as a good clarification of what well-being is?
Yeah, I generally use the definition as feeling well and functioning well. And that's very context and situation dependent. So in some situations, you feel well and function well, and in others not. That's also where the agency comes in. So please spend as much time as possible in the situations where you feel well and function well. We did a lot of studies on all these different measurements from quality of life, happiness, satisfaction with life, also more at the eudaimonic side, purpose, meaning. And when you look at it from a nature-nurture perspective, we see that it has one underlying set of genes. From my perspective, it doesn't really matter. In general, when people score high on happiness, they also score high on satisfaction with life. They also score high on meaning in life. There is this interesting discussion that is not solved yet. Are you first happy and then you can live a meaningful life, or the other way around? We don't have the right study with the right data yet to draw any conclusions. And also in my field of genetics, we need huge sample sizes. So also often based on the research and for pragmatic reasons, we combine many measurements together.
And so does that mean that, well, maybe that's a different question there, is the differentiators there hedonic well-being or the definition of happiness? Are you doing things that you love and that give you gratification, and eudaimonic well-being, which is more about that striving aspect? And whilst they might be interlinked, they do exist separately or perhaps could co-support each other.
Yeah, I always wonder if it brings the field any further if we keep on spending time on discussing if it's different, if it's similar. It's strongly linked, it's strongly associated. A very interesting research question is the direction of causation, but probably the answer will be it's bidirectional, and for some people it's better to or easier to feel happy and then thrive, or the other way around. And maybe in one period in your life you feel happy and then thrive, and another period you have a meaningful experience and you become happy. So it's not static. I also think we shouldn't waste too much time, because if you look at the total variation in the population, it's more about people that are high on all these well-being measures versus people that are in the middle and low. And I think that's more important for our world problems and for the challenges we face, to look at these differences than to start discussing endlessly at the end point of more positive or more negative aspects.
Oh, okay, so that's useful for my understanding of well-being from the point of view that I suppose I've already always assumed that eudaimonic well-being might surface some tactics that you're using day to day to enable you to thrive, to whether that is good daily habits that allow you to flourish. So that's sort of a functional version, and perhaps hedonic, maybe it's more separate. I want to go surfing, go and enjoy nice scenery. But actually doing happy things might allow you just to crack on and do your work in a more engaged way. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. And from a biological perspective, you probably have one set of genes, and there are many variants involved. So it's not like two or three genes. We have over 300 genetic variants identified at the moment. So, and it will be more. And that all comes together, giving you this genetic predisposition. happen. And change in your feelings can come from different environmental sources or different habits or different changes in your habits. But it's not that with one change of habit, you will only affect your eudaimonic well-being and not your hedonic well-being. And society is also expecting something. So sometimes it's said, well, the easy hedonic stuff is not important, but it is, because you need to feel well. It should start with well-being. And if that makes you happy and then gives you the energy or the openness to change, that is a big step. And that's maybe more important than thriving to be meaningful every day, for example.
Mm. And in terms of the dimensions of the responses that you might have, whether that is how I respond to a certain situation or a certain experience, as well as the context that I'm in, or maybe separately from the context I'm in, I might enjoy gardening, for example. I might enjoy exercising, but if I go into work, perhaps I might not enjoy that. I shouldn't say that because I run my own business with my wife, but that's a working example that other people might give.
Yeah.
I might not be as happy. Does your experience differ overall, but ultimately your well-being is an aggregation or a way up of the different situations?
Yeah, I always explain it as life should be a balance between energy gainers and drainers, and the energy gainers should be the winners. So you should actually end the day. You could be like physically or physiologically tired or exhausted, but mentally you should be energized at the end of the day because you did very exciting stuff and you have new ideas to start the next day. And if that's not the case, then you should start changing your life. And it doesn't matter where the energy comes from. If you have a working day that you like, but the energy comes from gardening afterwards or exercising, perfectly fine. If you don't feel miserable at work, well, then there's no reason to change. On the other hand, if you don't feel very well at work, you could change to get this extra energy gainer into your life by changing jobs. So we spend a lot of time at work, so it better be good.
Mm. And does that offer you almost a wheel of things that you could explore and examine? You mentioned purpose, happiness, flourishing, satisfaction with life, quality of life, meaning. Do they offer subtle differences that you could then think, well, I might be happy, but I haven't really got purpose, or I might be I might have meaning, but I'm not really satisfied with certain aspects of my life.
I wonder in the end if that takes up too much energy, actually.
It makes you unhappy.
Who you are. Some people like to contemplate about their lives always. But my easiest advice is always stop with the things that don't make you happy. And that's easy and not always reality. But it's this basic feeling of feeling well when you're somewhere doing something, and you can start spending a lot of energy on trying to sort out if that's because it's meaningful or because it simply makes you happy. Does it really matter? You feel well, you feel energized, you're open to other people, you're open to collaborations, you're open to anything. Does it really matter why? No, you feel well, so you can conquer the world.
I should call you every day. this is quite a G up. So maybe we can get into the idea of the things that you can change. But a lot of your work is focusing on genetic factors and how they relate to well-being. So these are things that you've been gifted. I'm not necessarily feeling as though I'm going to be able to respond too much to the factors that you've identified, but are there some common things that stand out in your genetics that ultimately determine your well-being and happiness? And is there a proportion of those that influence how much of your well-being and happiness is determined by your genetics?
Yeah. Well, this is very important question, because this is how the world looks at genetics and the balance and the percentages. First of all, the studies that we do, it's either twin family studies or molecular genetic studies, that gives us an estimate of the heritability of well-being, of happiness or meaning in life. It doesn't matter what the definition is at the moment. In those studies in Europe, in the United States, but we also did it in many other areas in the world, we mostly find a heritability estimate of 40%. That 40% means that 40% of the differences between people are accounted for by genetic differences. It doesn't say anything about your individual level well-being. It's a population statistic talking about the variation between people. If we go to an individual level, some people have a high genetic predisposition and some people have a low genetic predisposition. Currently, we are not in the situation, we don't have the techniques to have a reliable answer to how high your genetic predisposition is. I did it, like I said in the beginning, but the unreliability is very high, so we're not using that in real life yet. But people know, you know if you have a high genetic predisposition or low genetic predisposition. So you can't say a certain percentage of your happiness is accounted for by genes and the other amount by environment. That is a wrong interpretation of the heritability. Very important addition also is, if something is heritable, it doesn't mean it can't change. So this heritability of 40% describes the differences between people. So it gives us this famous distribution, normal distribution, because it's a standardized measure. If you start training well-being, you can switch the whole population, sorry, to the better side. To draw a parallel that is often easily understood by people is if you look at the physical condition of people. Everybody's born with a certain cardiovascular system. Some systems are better, some systems are worse. So you start off with an unequal position on your cardiovascular condition. Some people are very high, some people are very low. If you start training, if you get a running schedule, whatever training you do, everybody will move to the better side. But some people will move faster, some people will move slower, and the ones that were high will never be passed by the ones that were low. We all shift. And that's what happens also to well-being. So the distribution, the differences between people are accounted partly by genetic differences, but we can all train and become all better.
So I know and I can understand the difference between me and Eliud Kipchoge or me and Usain Bolt in terms of, I know there's a fundamental difference.
Yeah.
I know that there is that is going to be underpinned by genetic differences. And there's a sense that they have high genetic predisposition for their events, but ultimately I can get faster or I can develop my endurance.
Yeah. And it's not only their genetics. It's if you look at top athletes or top soccer players, it's a combination of their predisposition and the environment. Because they are, of course, selected at a very young age and then have been in the opportunity to develop in optimized environments to get the golden medal at the Olympics. So that is an excellent example of gene-environment interplay. Putting someone with the genetic predisposition to thrive in the environment that makes it also happen.
I've often said I don't think Usain Bolt is the fastest person in the world. I think he's the fastest person in the world that does track and field athletics and had the opportunity to go to a track club.
Yeah, yeah. And has been supported from early onwards in training and anything. Yeah.
So are there specific genetics that are identifiable, or genetic factors that are identifiable that might predispose somebody to be higher? Is it worth just sharing any of those aspects of those that are perhaps supportive of higher well-being, or actually if in the absence of or presence of certain factors can undermine that well-being?
Yeah, well, what we do in our genome-wide association studies is that we do a blind search for genetic variants that explain differences in well-being between people. those studies are huge. We have 2 million people in a study, and they all have a well-being measure and a DNA assessment. And in this blind search, the last one we conducted, we found over 300 locations on the human genome. That's not genes. That is single variant locations that are part of genes. Well, that sounds like a lot. In the end, taking them all together only explains 2% of the variation between people. So of the 40% that we know from twin family studies, we currently can explain 2% by the genetic factors. What we don't do for our human complex traits like well-being is diving into one gene, because there is no one gene. It's already 300 variants. If we have a bigger study, it will be 800, 1,200, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000. I don't even know what the limit will be. So we don't know a specific location. The only thing we now know is that these variants that are important for well-being are expressed in a certain area in the brain. That's the cubiculum, which is part of the hippocampus. That is not really an innovative finding, because the hippocampus has been linked to depressive symptoms and other mood-related feelings of human beings. So it's more a proof of principle that indeed these genetic variants might be linked to well-being. But we will never get to the stage saying this particular gene is influencing this particular pathway, biological pathway, coding for this protein, and then explaining well-being in a biological way. That is not expected for a complex trait like well-being.
And so of those factors that you've recognized, that seems like mapping the territory, understanding what the underpinnings are. But as you point out, that might explain some of the variation, but ultimately it sounds like, what are you going to do about it anyway, regardless of your state?
Yeah.
Do certain types of interventions have more effectiveness if perhaps you've got a lower predisposition or a lower well-being, whether it's anxiety or depression, versus others that might support you to go even further if you're happy and well?
Yeah, well, one of the so what we indeed do is, like you say, we can build a composite score of all these variants. So you get a polygenic score, as we call it. That has been established in the past for schizophrenia. That's why it's sometimes called a polygenic risk score. But for well-being, it sounds a bit strange to have a high polygenic risk score for well-being. So it's a polygenic score. And this score will be in the future, I think, a nice addition to the clinical field. Imagine if we now have people that come in with depressive symptoms, and they're all put in the same container, and they all get the same protocol, starting with either therapy or medication or a mix, whatever. If you at the beginning be able to assess their genetic profile and say, okay, you have a high score, a high polygenic score for well-being, well, maybe try some positive psychology interventions, because you have this predisposition that is not used at the moment. So we could try to ignite it and use it. Same the other way around. If you have a high polygenic score for depressive symptoms, I would expect that maybe medication works better, because maybe you have a biological disturbance. If you have a very low polygenic score, then it's an environmentally caused depressive episode, and then maybe therapy would be the better choice. Well, this balance and adding this extra layer of information to the current clinical practice, I think, has strong added value for people.
That's a working hypothesis at the moment, as opposed to something you're seeing in the research findings.
Yeah, that is one reason why we try to understand the genetics, is to try to go beyond the one size fits all. So like you say, with interventions, we also do studies in genetically informative designs with well-being interventions to sort out what works for whom. Because one size never fits all. And we have to sort out, okay, if you do, what kind of intervention you do? Is what kind of people benefit from a certain intervention?
And you mentioned how genes interact with the environment. Could you help me with this area in terms of the understanding? Because the whole nature-nurture seems like a very glib way of viewing the world about anything. But it strikes me as that there's a difference between the gene-environment interaction as well as just a very supportive environment that might support. What do I need to know around this particular area?
Yeah, well, there are two things. There's this gene-environment interaction. And that has like the simple definition that due to differences in genetic profile between people, they can react and have a different response to the same environment. So the simplest example, if people go outside and there's a lot of sunshine, then some people skins burn and other get tanned. Same sun, same location, different outcome due to the pigmentation of your skin, which is for 100% driven by your genotype. So your genotype actually explains the differences in response to the environment. That's a gene-environment interaction, and that happens all day. So everything that happens in the environment has a different effect on different people because we are genetically different. Same why some people get ill when they smoke a lot and other people don't. They all smoke the same cigarettes, but some people develop certain illnesses while others not. And then people say, how could that happen? Well, that's because they are genetically different. Same with training. Some people train for a marathon and run it easily with under 4 hours. Some people train hours and hours and will never finish. Gene-environment interaction. The other you mentioned is gene-environment correlation, meaning that that's in different forms. Parents, they transmit their genes to the children, but they also create the environment. So for well-being, you can then come into the situation of double advantage. So I have an above average genetic predisposition for well-being. I transmit this to my children, but I also create the environment, the optimistic environment. So they are in double advantage. Well, you can imagine there's also double disadvantage. People with genetic predispositions for depressive symptoms, for example. Another aspect of gene-environment correlation is that you evoke certain responses from your environment due to genetic predisposition. Simplest case is some people have a happy face and others don't. I always tend to make pictures from people. If I run into someone with a really happy face, I ask, can I take a picture? Because I use it in my lecture. Some people always get positive responses, others not. Well, the shape of your face, like the size of your eyes, the position of your mouth, is all dictated by your genes. So the genes created your face, and your face evokes a certain response of the environment. Evocative gene-environment correlation. Then the final one is that based on your genotype, you pick a certain environment. And that's an important one for well-being. If you are an introvert person, you maybe don't want to go to big bars with a lot of people every time, even though people are saying, yeah, you need to be social, you need to be out there with friends. You don't feel like doing that, then you shouldn't do that. Or if you like exercising, then go exercising. But there are a lot of people think they should exercise, but they hate it. Well, then stop exercising and do something else to stay healthy. So you can pick your own environment based on your genotype. And that's what people actually constantly are doing. If you look at our educational system, people have a certain predisposition for cognitive development, and they are not in random environments. And you can pick your own challenges. So genes, for a certain amount, drive who you are and what you do.
So four different levels for me to be aware of.
yeah. And they all happen all the time.
I'm just almost imagining maybe something like doing a speech. That somebody might have a stress-based wake up of the amygdala, some cortisol running through their veins because of their predisposition. They might have had parents who have said, actually, that's a great opportunity. So they take opportunities in life. Someone might have certain facial characteristics or something about their posture that adds a bit of charisma to their effectiveness in those situations, as well as actually selecting and thinking, actually, I like the look of that. I like the look of standing up on stage. So there could be different responses to what could be a stressful, but also a growth-based opportunity.
Yeah. And that's then, in the end, like I say, where the definition of well-being comes in. When you feel well and function well, that is somewhere on this like biological crossroad of your predispositions and the things that your parents or your family or your environment brought into you. That's why it's important to, if you want to feel well, and if you want to achieve the society that I aim for, that's a society based on well-being, you should start with who you are and who you want to be. And that is actually staying as close to biology as possible. Because your biology is there, and well, use it in the right way, and then you feel well.
And
very important for people, we always think, if we think about genetics, we think about parents and children. But your family is big. So again, for exercise, some people sometimes say, I'm an exerciser, my husband is an exerciser, but well, our child doesn't like exercise. How is that possible? And then you say, well, could you like think back in your family? And then you probably have one uncle, aunt, niece or nephew that doesn't like exercising. So there's a lot in your genotype that you don't use, but have gotten from your parents and still can be transmitted to your child. So it's more complex than only parents and children.
Suddenly my daughter's behaviors are making a lot more sense.
They're positive behaviors, I assume.
Absolutely. But perhaps a tendency or reluctance to do certain types of things.
Yeah.
Does that, you've mentioned environment several times, but I've seen you use a word, exposome. It sort of speaks a little bit more to just the environment in terms of the bricks and mortar, the people around you. Could you tell me a little bit more about that as a term and how that's perhaps a little bit beyond just the environment?
Yeah, the exposome is, I think it's a beautiful term actually, because the exposure to outside stuff, like environments, starts very early. So the egg that is in the female that actually gets into the child later on is already affected by her lifestyle, by her environment. So as soon as there is a creation of a child, the environment starts hitting in. If the mother is very active while she's pregnant, what she eats, what she drinks, how much stress she experiences. So it's this constant exposure to external stuff that influences who you are, who you become, and who you will be. So it's more a term to indeed show that it's way bigger than just the green area around the corner. It's everywhere, always. And that's also the complexity that often people say, well, you study genetics and environment. Genetics is complex. And so, well, no, genetics is easy. We know the human genome. We know how it's built, how it reacts, what it's doing. It's fixed. It's always there. We know the structure. The environment is like changing by the second, by the millisecond, always. It's hard to measure. It's never stable. So although we tend to know a lot about the environment, we don't. We claim it, but it's not the case because we always ignore the genetic effects as well. So the environment is like, that's the biggest challenge, to understand the environmental effects.
Are there any big effects of your direct environment? I mean, if you were to look at sort of environmental inputs and factors, what are the things that perhaps persist as the things that support or degrade well-being?
Yeah, well, we did one study in a similar fashion as the genetic study. So we did an environment-wide association study So not picking and choosing certain environmental factors, but just throw everything into the mix based on postal codes. So that's a limitation of the study because you're not always at your postal code, but right. That was the starting point. We ended up with over 160 environmental factors like air pollution, but also green space, the possibility of educational settings, leisure time activities, all that kind of stuff. And after doing this whole study, and the first thing that popped up was all kinds of socioeconomic status factors. So how rich is the neighborhood? How many houses? What's the house price? And all that kind of stuff. After correcting for socioeconomic status factors of the neighborhood and the individual, we had one factor left, and that was safety. So regardless of a genetic predisposition, regardless of socioeconomic status, safety is an important factor for everybody. Importantly, then comes in the question, what is safety?
Mm.
Because what you consider to be safety might not be the same thing for me. So I think it has a lot of implications for policymakers, and they should take the next step and understand what is safety for whom. Because it's not a one-size-fits-all. And that is actually with many environmental factors. So there's also many studies that show that social connections and social support are important factors for well-being. We also showed it in one of our studies. That is what you generally find. But what is social interaction meaning for people? For you, it could mean that you want to hang out with friends and family every week. To me, it could mean that I want to be with my family but hang out with friends only once a month. So you really should sort out, okay, that's important. Everybody should be important to someone. Someone should see you, should give you attention. But the frequency, the number of friends, the quality of that in your perspective could be different than someone else's perspective. So also there, it's not a one-size-fits-all. And that's partly based on your genotype. What you want, how you feel, and what you expect from social support.
Right. So just listening to you there, thinking about controlling for socioeconomic background, I would imagine that that's such a big factor in terms of income, being in a thriving environment, absence of distress such as cold or crime, lacking food or uncertainty. And if you then have safety as a feature, that could mean quite literal house safety. Do I feel safe at night? Do I feel safe walking in my neighborhood? But yeah, that could have a fairly strong psychological aspect about whether I'm a bit neurotic or exactly, or whether yeah, I've taken diligent steps to prepare myself for being in the outdoor world.
True, and it could be even if you stay within one of these factors that you mentioned, so safety outside. Then you could think about the lightning in the street, street lights. But that's not you don't need the same street light that I do. So even such a simple factor that we might agree on, in practice could be meaning something completely different. Because I think, well, I need a certain amount of light, but I also want to be careful about the environment and the ecosystem. So I can do with a little light. And you say, well, I really, really want a lot of light to feel safe. And that's a different balance. So yeah, it's different for everybody.
And so taking that particular idea further, we spend a lot of time at work. Do you have a sense of some of the factors in work that support well-being in work?
That's always a very interesting question, because also in that area, there are a lot of claims, one-size-fits-all claims about hierarchy, agency, control, while all these factors are very, very personal. So also at work, you should sort out what for you the best way of working is. There's nothing wrong with a certain level of hierarchy in a company if people like that. If you don't like that, you can try to change it or go to another company. Agency is important for many people, but not to the same level for everybody. So also there, I think all these factors are important, but people need to sort out what is important to them. Some people say, well, I really want to go to work and want someone else to tell me what to do. That gives me comfort. I can finish it. At the end of the day, I'm done and I can do something else. Other people say, don't tell me what to do. I know what to do and I want the agency myself. Different people, different circumstances, different situations. I yesterday actually had a discussion about team sizes. There are all these like evolutionary psychology theories about how big groups should be, what your span of control is. In general, there's probably a certain range, but not a fixed number. Maybe for me, I feel comfortable in a group of 10 people, while you say I would prefer 5 people. So it's all exploring and try and error to see what's working. It's not set in stone. And also maybe when you're young and you get your first leadership position, you easily control 10 people or collaborate in a nice way with 10 people. And when you get older and you collaborate on a different way, you rather work with 5 people because it's more intense collaborations or whatever. And that could be different for everybody.
So I certainly take that point about individual preferences and you might prefer this, I might prefer that. I guess from a management point of view, that would be quite tricky to attend to various different needs when actually you need to be fairly efficient. You need to have some semblance of a common approach to creating a good environment without necessarily micromanaging or getting into the weeds mm-hmm. for every single person.
Yeah, well, I think it starts with really listening to the people. Because often it's often very small things, and it's also often about creating the safety in the environment for being different than other people. So, for example, if you say, well, we always have lunch at this big table and everybody should be there. Why? Some people don't want to be there. So give the freedom to be there, create different areas where people can take lunch. It could also be very easy things that you don't consider to be important. Same with like, at what time should you start? You can say, well, we always start at 9. Why? Is that, that could be efficient. But I think it's inefficient because if people need to start at 9 while they prefer to start at 10, I think they make up. They if they get the freedom to start an hour later, they probably also feel the obligation to do their work better and thrive instead of, well, feeling annoyed about a 9 o'clock starting point. So I think it's always sounds difficult and it always sounds, yeah, but then everybody wants something different. I wonder. I think there's a lot of things that people agree upon or it's small things that can be changed. It's just, I think we never really listen to people, what they want. And also, does it really matter if they all have like white walls and someone says, I really, really want a green wall? Who cares? Make it green. That's not our corporate strategy. Yeah, for what? What's your corporate strategy? Making people happy, I assume. I think it's always made way more complex than reality is.
And so that's very interesting from the point of view of your suggestion there is to listen to people, to find out. And I suppose the very act of asking, what makes you happy? What would you like to do? Be an agent of creating the environment that supports you. As we've sort of started off, you've got the signatures on your walls that you've chosen to create. That sounds like there's one of the common approaches there that you could take is actually agree it. We're going to agree to engage you in the process. And you can engage to a certain degree or not. Yeah. But ultimately, I suppose there's going to need to be an accountability. Otherwise, it's probably just anarchy and people running around doing what they want. You need to be able to get the work done.
Yeah, you can, it's not a free flow and a free play, but it really starts by having intrinsic attention and interest in other people. So really ask them the question, how do you feel? What keeps you busy? But also listen to the answer and take responsibility of what the answer could be and where you could support people or facilitate people in fulfilling the things they say. And don't be afraid. And sometimes you can say, well, that is impossible in the current situation or in our company or today or this week or whatever. It's not that everything should be fulfilled. People understand if you really listen to them and have a fair reason to say, well, we can't do that at the moment. That's a fair answer. Then there's two responses. Either that person accepts it or needs to find another job. But we already start at the beginning and we don't listen. We don't even ask the questions. How often do people ask the question, how do you feel? Really, with the intention to understand how you feel instead of being it the automatic question in the corridor or the elevator. And also what keeps you busy is it's actually more important because people say, well, I'll feel well. That's fine. Then it's over. No, start the conversation and keep on doing that, not only on the Monday, but every day and listen to the answers. And I think it's if it's really big things that bother people, then there's not the right match between the company and that person. And then you have a responsibility to help them to sort out what would be the right match.
Mm.
But it starts actually with the person that for yourself to explore who you are, to actually answer these questions. How do you feel? What keeps you busy? You need to know how you feel and what keeps you busy. So always be actively exploring who you are, what you want to be is something you could do. And you don't have to do it alone. It's your journey, but you can always be facilitated and supported by other people by discussing, by asking questions yourself. And that's this constant developing phase of your own life.
I suppose that phrase that you mentioned at the start, stop doing things that make you unhappy, that for some people might be a realization that I get to choose, because some people might just feel stuck or that they are frozen in state and don't necessarily have the confidence to step into the unknown. They'd perhaps rather sit and suffer a little bit.
Yeah. No, I always say don't make all kinds of big changes at one moment, but you could start by people do a lot of things because it's expected from them, or they think it's expected from them by society, by your friends, by whoever, your boss. And often it's not really the case, but it's your idea or your perception that it's expected from you. And if it really doesn't make you happy, why do it? A simple exercise. A lot of people go to the gym for exercising. Like exercising itself, or at least moving and being active, is important for your physiological health. That is without any doubt. But it doesn't mean you need to go to the gym. It could also mean you could take a walk outside or take the stairs more often or do anything else that you like. So I always tell the people, why buy an expensive gym entrance fee? Why you hate it? Then it's every day or twice a week you go to do something you hate. I think that is useless energy. And same holds for many social factors. People think, I have to be there. Oh, why? You can always ask the question, why?
It fits very well with last week's podcast recording with Stuart Biddle talking about the role of exercise specifically in alleviating depressive symptoms, but also having that agency of engaging in the things that you prefer rather than thinking that I've got to conform with 150 minutes on a treadmill at a certain speed.
Yeah.
I'm interested to hear your thoughts on, I suppose, environments that require effort and perhaps discomfort, such as the world of elite sport, where there has to be a degree of industry. I mean, that idea that you've said about feeling well and functioning well. Functioning well will probably come from enhanced physiological, psychological abilities, but it's not always going to feel well. People are going to be in a position where they're suffering with injury. They're going to have periods probably now towards the, as people get closer to the Olympics, of very high training volumes that are very demanding. What's your sense of how well well-being fits with high, extraordinary high performance?
Yeah, well, I think in the end, high performance athletes should at the end of the day feel well. It could be one day, well, if you're like get injured like now before the Olympics in Paris, that's a nightmare. I love the Olympics. I can also imagine the feeling of the nightmare that you can't go there. But in general, also top athletes should in the end feel well. And suffering is not a problem if it has a certain aim. So if you suffer now with a lot of training because you think that it's possible to get the golden medal or go to the Olympics itself, which is a golden medal, I think, to everybody. That's part of the deal in life, that you have to do things that are not nice, but brings you somewhere, helps you with developing. And that's the same what I like I say to my children. I hate school. Yeah. Well, school is maybe boring, but it's a step to bring you to a certain part in life that you can do what you enjoy doing. So, I think that it can't be only suffering. That is, and how long the suffer period can be in an exceptional year as an Olympic year, I don't know. But and that's also person specific.
I think that the interesting thing that in sports psychology that sort of relates in a parallel way is flow state. That people are in this sort of transcendental state of flow, everything is present, it feels easy. And that was seen as the sort of gold standard. If you can get to that place, then you know you'll be at your best. And this rise of this idea of the clutch state of effortful forcing to get the performance out of yourself rather than it just happening almost like a trance. That sort of feels a bit like a similarity that perhaps you can put up with some of the pain for a period of time if it is taking you somewhere, if it's achieving something.
Yeah. And the only risk is that people go on and on to reach this flow state that some people might never reach. But I think it's needed to have success to also accept the suffering at some point. So you need to have progress, but realistic progress. And what we see in the world of exercise is that we have these one size fits all schedules often. So there's this idea of if you are here, then you have to reach a certain point after training this and this and this. Which might not be the case for you at that moment in time. So the adaptability of what to expect from your own body and your own mental state is, I think, should be flexible. And I think they are getting there in the exercise world now instead of expecting a certain fixed schedule.
Yeah, I think certainly a lot of what you've mentioned in terms of the environment, the ability to speak openly about your experiences as an elite athlete, social connection, social support, all of these things can make the rather intense environment a little bit more manageable or even happy. Fascinating stuff, Maker. What how do you look after your well-being?
My well-being, a bit of exercising. Not always successful. I was a runner, but I had a spine problems and surgeries and all that kind of stuff. Now I'm a swimmer, which is a new experience, but I like because I like learning new things. So that is nice. I love my work. That is a good thing. So I love developing, learning new stuff. I love to read things I don't know, talk to people that have different experiences and expertise. And I love being with my family if they behave. No.
Is that when you vary the time? I'd like to see you next week. Actually, I'd like to see you in 6 months.
You're now an energy drainer, so I don't want to see you, and now you're an energy gain. No, it's the balance of everything, and I like to live at a relatively high speed of life. It should not be boring, and that's not my well-being thing. So,
very good.
Things.
It sounds like your hippocampus is overflowing there with all the relevant activities. So really appreciate the conversation. Fascinating to hear you unpack your work and how actually it's an active process to support your own well-being, but there's many opportunities should people choose to take that step forward.
Yes, yes.
Excellent. Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen. I really hope you enjoyed this week's conversation. Now, we've got plenty more to come, so if you'd like to support and champion us, then take the time to subscribe and leave a review on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or wherever you tune in. You can also give us a follow on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. All the links are in the show notes. So, in the meantime, have a great week.